Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ken McKenzie, and on behalf of the executive of the Vancouver Institute, I would like to welcome you to the fifth of our 1993 spring series of lectures. May I remind you that Institute lectures are open to the public without entry fee, but our program is dependent on the financial support of our members. Membership fees are modest, $15 for a family membership, and I would urge you to join the Institute if you have not already done so. Before introducing tonight's speaker, may I remind you that next Saturday evening, Homero Arides, the Mexican novelist and diplomat, will discuss the background to his best-selling novel, 1492, The Life and Times of Juan Cabazon of Castile, the history of a historical novel. The lecture this evening is the E. Gordon Young Memorial Lecture, sponsored by the Chemical Institute of Canada. Our guest is Alan First, Herschel Smith Professor of Organic Chemistry at Cambridge University. Professor First is a graduate of Cambridge and obtained his PhD there in 1965. He has had a distinguished career in research, emphasizing a combination of physical and organic chemistry with molecular biology to study enzyme mechanism and protein structure and activity. Much of Dr. First's research has been conducted at Cambridge, although for 10 years he was at the Imperial College London as the Wolfson Research Professor of the Royal Society. He has given special lectures frequently at other universities in Britain and North America, including Harvard, Rutgers, Berkeley, and Edinburgh. His outstanding work has been recognized internationally by a number of prestigious awards, most recently the 1991 Gaber Medal of the Royal Society, the 1992 Max Tischler Prize Lectureship of Harvard, and the 1993 Hardin Medal and Jubilee Lecture of the Biomedical Society. Dr. First's subject tonight is protein engineering, basic research and biotechnology. Professor First.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you very much for inviting me here. It's indeed a pleasure to be able to address you. Let's find my way around by discovering about the slides. Molecular biology concerns itself to a considerable extent with studying three major classes of molecules, some of which are very famous: DNA, RNA, and proteins. Deoxyribonucleic acid, ribonucleic acid, and proteins. DNA is the repository of information in the cell. All the characteristics of an individual, and all the information necessary for that individual to survive and replicate, is stored in DNA in the terms of a code. DNA is a linear polymer consisting of just four components, abbreviated to A, T, G, and C. It consists of two strands that match up with each other so that the information is duplicated in its mirror image in the second strand, and this enables it to be replicated. As well as having all the necessary information for various devices, the DNA, in its linear sequence of code, contains all of the information for specifying the sequence of proteins. Now, proteins, these important biomolecules, consist of a linear sequence of monomers called amino acid residues. There are 20 different ones, and the 20 different amino acids occur in different lengths in different proteins. On this slide, we have the structure of a good Canadian discovered protein, insulin. What is important about all proteins, including insulin, is not so much the linear nature of the protein, just writing it out this way. What is important about it is its three-dimensional structure. I have on this slide the representation of the structure of insulin, four different views of it. This structure was determined by Dorothy Crowfoot Hodgkins using X-ray crystallography many years ago. We have at the bottom the protein. It in fact consists of six basic units that come together, shown as individual atoms. And it's a sphere of atoms. If one looks more closely into the packing of these atoms and looks at the sequence of the amino acid chain through the molecule, one sees, in fact, fits rather beautiful patterns of regular structure, some of which is helical, others of different shapes. It's worthwhile mentioning some people involved in this with whom I've had the privilege of sharing a laboratory in Cambridge for the formative years of my life. We have here some views of Francis Crick in 1979, who many years before with Watson postulated the helical structure of DNA. We have here Fred Sanger, who's won, not one, but two Nobel Prizes. One for determining the sequence of amino acid residues in proteins. In particular, he started with insulin. And then more recently, he was able to determine the sequence of the code in DNA, for which he received a second Nobel Prize. And finally, we have Max Perutz, the father of protein crystallography, who was able to start the subject by which nowadays we know the structure of many proteins. The information in DNA is converted into proteins by a series of processes. The DNA is too precious a material to be handled directly, so its information is first of all transcribed to a molecule called ribonucleic acid, which is very similar to DNA, just that each unit contains another oxygen atom. The sequence of DNA makes RNA, makes proteins, was once termed the central dogma of molecular biology. More recently, the dogma has been changed somewhat because there are certain viruses in which the information flow of DNA to RNA to proteins is altered because these viruses contain their information in RNA. For example, the HIV virus does so, and the RNA is converted into DNA. And so we now have this scheme with DNA to RNA and possibly back again to proteins, and also makes dollars, and that's in biotechnology. The DNA and RNA molecules are responsible for information storage and processing, but the action involves proteins. I once saw a poster in a biotechnology lab which says proteins is where the rubber hits the road, because this is where the work of the cell is done. Proteins are the constituents of most of the important functions of the cell. For example, proteins form important structures. Hair is a protein. Muscle is a protein. Proteins involved in catalysis, all reactions that take place in the cell are catalyzed, are speeded up by enzymes. And with one exception, enzymes are proteins. Proteins are also involved in work, again in muscle, in movement, in pumping chemicals around. And proteins are also involved in defense. The first line of defense, antibodies, are made of proteins. That's under control. The term genetic engineering means different things to different people. But for most molecular biologists, genetic engineering concerns the manipulation of DNA and doing experiments in bacteria. Genes are made of DNA. It was found possible in the early 1970s to be able to take genes from one organism and insert them into carriers in bacteria so that the gene could be expressed in that bacteria and so-called recombinant genes could be made. This led to the first important uses of molecular biology. Until then, one could just admire the beauty of the concepts. But with the advent of genetic engineering, molecular biology was put to use. Over the years, being able to manipulate genes has led to the following types of important work. First of all, in terms of research, it's given information on the structure of genes and basis of cancer, etc. It's also given important information about inherited illnesses, such as cystic fibrosis. There's work on Canada by Dr. Tsui on cystic fibrosis, which has proven to be exceedingly important. This type of work is the basis of DNA fingerprinting, with its use in forensic research and also more scientific matters. But very importantly, it's provided a means of producing large quantities of proteins. In the past, the only proteins that were studied in depth were those that could be handled in large quantities. And these really consist of a small number of readily available proteins. But genetic engineering and recombinant DNA technology made it possible for proteins to be made in large quantities by producing them in bacteria by cloning their genes into these carriers. And this has enabled the production of large quantities of proteins for research and also, again, for useful processes such as providing insulin or tissue plasminogen activator for use in after heart attacks. In the late 1970s, work in this area progressed further and led to the birth of protein engineering. Protein engineering is the production of novel proteins in bacteria generally by manipulating their genes. For example, instead of putting a natural gene into its carrier in a bacterium, changes can be made in that gene, and so that proteins of altered structure will be produced. The pioneer of this work I'm pleased to say is Mike Smith, who in the late 1970s introduced the technique of site-directed mutagenesis, whereby changes could be made in DNA at precise locations to make precise alterations in the protein. And a few years later, my colleague Greg Winter and I collaborated with Mike Smith to make the first changes in proteins of known structure so that their properties could be altered. And this has proven to be an important process over the years. In particular, protein engineering is to proteins what synthesis is to organic chemistry. Just as the chemist can make novel chemicals so that they can be used in new processes or for new purposes on the one hand, or to make new molecules for studying molecules on the other hand, so protein engineering can be used to make new proteins for similar reasons. And since the first experiments of some 10 or 12 years ago, protein engineering has been used to improve the structure of enzymes for use. It's been used to redesign antibodies, the first line of defense, in terms of a synthetic process. And in terms of analysis, it's been used for various activities in studying the structure and activity of proteins, the recognition of molecules in biology, and, as I'm going to talk about a bit later, the very process of proteins folding up. Well, what can we do? How far have we got in making new proteins from scratch? Well, the biggest problem, the biggest intellectual challenge in the area of science in which I work is a problem called the protein folding problem. And it really goes like this. We have, nowadays, the sequence of many, many proteins being produced very rapidly. And this is because the methods introduced by Sanger and subsequent generations have enabled the sequence of DNA in genes to be determined very rapidly. And there are now projects worldwide determining the sequence of all the DNA in the human genome and other genomes. So we're getting vast amounts of linear information being spewed out. So for example, we would have somebody determining the sequence of DNA and reading out a code. And the code for amino acids consists of a three-letter series of events. So we would have the code in DNA being read out and printed out. And then a computer can translate this code very simply into the amino acid constituents of the protein it codes for. So here we have the DNA sequence of a particular protein. It's one I work on called Barnase. And underneath that is the amino acid residues that it refers to. So very quickly, we know the sequence of that protein. However, as I mentioned earlier, the important thing about proteins is their three-dimensional structure, their shape. And what we really want to know is the shape of this protein. And you can see this particular protein has some beautiful features. It has some helical regions. It has some nice strands of amino acids going backwards and forwards and other helical regions. And these determine what that protein does. And what we want to be able to do is really to solve the second half of the genetic code and know how this linear sequence goes into that structure. One could make this sequence of amino acid residues chemically, not in the body, and that sequence will fold up spontaneously into that shape. And what we want to know is how that happens. I'm afraid to say this cannot be calculated at present, and I'll tell you why. Consider the number of possibilities open to this protein. Consider all of these amino acid residues and the different positions they could take up in space. Suppose there were only just two different positions available to each one of those amino acid residues, and this is a total underestimate of the number of possibilities. there will be 2^100 different possibilities for a protein of 100 amino acid residues in it. Now, 2^100 is a pretty meaningless number to most people, but to put it into perspective, 2^100 is greater than the number of atoms in the universe. And there's an old story I have just remembered about an ancient Persian who'd done something very useful for the Shah, and the Shah said, "What reward do you want?" And he said, "Well, I have a chessboard of 64 squares, so I'd like you to put 1 grain of corn on square 1, and 2 on square 2, and 4 on square 3, etc., etc." And the Shah said, "Yes, but of course that would have used by square 30 or something more corn than there would be in the universe." These numbers are huge. If all of these residues just spun around as fast as possible at the theoretical maximum rate, and so perhaps the protein would fold up at random, then it would take longer than the age of the universe to do so. So there are somewhere or other rules hidden within this protein that tells it how to fold up. And we want to know those, and we just don't know those yet. It's not even possible to calculate in a computer whether or not this protein is in fact stable. So what we can do at this stage is limited. We cannot design new proteins de novo. We can't design new proteins from scratch. But what we can do is to make changes in proteins. We're rather in the position of, say, a rather poor tailor, a tailor that cannot make a suit. But if he's given a suit, he can make small changes in it, like he could make the pocket slightly larger, or put turn-ups on the trousers, or take out the waistband. He couldn't make it from scratch, but he can make useful changes. But making useful changes is perfectly adequate for many purposes. And no more is this more useful, nowhere is it more useful than dealing with antibodies. Antibodies are, in many ways, the most accessible proteins for dealing with for uses in medicine and therapy. Because antibodies circulate in the blood to home in specifically on various targets, such as various infections or other processes, and they can also be used in medical tests. For example, antibodies, because they occur naturally to bind very specifically for precise objects, can be used extensively in diagnosis, for example, in pregnancy tests. They can also be used in a process called passive immunization. Normally, one raises one's own antibodies against a particular virus, but this takes time. Instead, one can be injected with antibodies from another source that are targeted against that particular virus or something else. And I'm sure everyone is aware of having shots of gamma globulins when one goes to places where there are various types of hepatitis. Gamma globulins, of course, antibodies. These can now be made and targeted at various purposes. For example, if a doctor receives a needle stick from a patient suffering from AIDS, it's possible for an injection of an antibody raised against AIDS. If babies in a ward are exposed to respiratory syncytial virus, for example, there are now antibodies available that can be used for this passive immunization. Antibodies are also used in therapy, and I'll be discussing extensively a little bit later on the uses of a particular antibody called CAMPATH. And antibodies, because they can be so specifically targeted against different molecules, can be used for detecting where things are. And for example, imaging. Antibodies can be directed against tumors or even atherosclerotic plaque, and these antibodies can be tagged either by a radioactive tag or something for NMR imaging, so that the surgeon can detect where these are occurring. And they're also targeting for therapy. Now, let me spend a few seconds describing how antibodies are now obtained. Is that visible enough, or should I get the screen down? Let's leave it like that. Milstein and Curler in Cambridge devised a method for making specific antibodies that are termed monoclonal antibodies. The process for making these is quite nasty and difficult, but it works. A mouse is injected with an antigen, a particular target to which an antibody is required to bind. After a while, its spleen is removed, and cells called B lymphocytes are extracted from this. These are then mixed together with myeloma cells. These are cells from a cancer, and under conditions where some of them fuse to give what is called a hybridoma. It's a fusion of the antibody-producing cells with the myeloma cells, and it becomes an immortal source for making the specific antibodies. A fermenter can then grow up these antibodies, and large amounts of monoclonal antibodies can be used for therapy. So a pure single antibody can be produced by this process, pure monoclonal antibodies. But this leads to a difficulty. It's not easy to repeat the same process for making monoclonal antibodies using a human being. The monoclonal antibodies are made by rodents. And then if these monoclonal antibodies are put into humans, the human immune system recognizes these foreign antibodies as being foreign, and therefore starts attacking them with its own antibodies. This was recognized at the very beginning of the century by von Behring and was termed serum sickness. So how can we go forward? We know how to make monoclonal antibodies, and some of these are very useful. What can be done is to use these mechanisms of protein engineering to start making monoclonal antibodies that can be used in human beings. And so the way to do this is to obtain the genes for these monoclonal antibodies, alter them, put them into cells, and make human ones. And how is this done? Well, this procedure was devised by my colleague Greg Winter, and he terms it humanizing antibodies. And he was able to convert rodent antibodies into human ones by the following process. We have here the structure of an antibody. It consists of many chains of amino acid residues, so-called constant regions, C, and the regions that bind the antigen are in the so-called variable regions, which are at the end of the antibody. And it transpires that only a very small amount of the antibody is actually involved in binding the antigen. It's not the whole molecule, just the small tip of the molecule. And what Greg Winter was able to do was to locate the antibody binding, the binding regions on the mouse antibody and transplant it into a human framework. He then obtained an antibody which had the specificity for binding of the rodent, it had the structure of the human. And so this antibody could be used for therapy. The first successful application of this was to humanize a rat antibody called CAMPATH, short for Cambridge Pathology. It was made by Herman Waldman, who by coincidence went to the same high school in London as me. And this antibody attacks and destroys certain cells called T and B lymphocytes. He originally made this antibody for use in transplant work to purge these T cells from bone marrow that was going to be used for transplant work, and so it would not be foreign in that situation. However, it became apparent that it could be used in vivo for treating particular cancers called lymphomas, which are derived from lymphocytes. And the rat antibody was in fact successful on one or two people, but in others caused reactions, serum sickness. However, the humanized antibody has been used very successfully, and I'll show you an example. So it's a rather dark slide. I always find it quite amazing that as technology improves with screen projection, it's always worse than the method before that. This slide will come up perfectly adequate on a straightforward front projection on a white screen. We have here the stomach of a woman at Anna Brooks Hospital at Cambridge, 70-year-old woman, and circled in black is a very large swelling, which is her spleen. It weighs several kilograms. She was then treated with this antibody, CAMPATH, and after a couple of weeks, it has shrunk, so it's much smaller and a little bit longer. The swelling disappeared. As you can see, in England, the National Health Service has reached such a state that they don't wash patients. So you can see where the original line was, where the spleen was enlarged. But this antibody then had further and further uses. There was in Adam Brooks also, a young girl of 19 who'd suffered for 4 years from a situation called polyarthritis. In this, the lymphocytes enter the synovium of the joints, they swell. The poor young girl was in a terminal state, close to death, in complete agony. She was resistant to all the treatments that had been tried till then, and it appeared hopeless. She was treated with CAMPATH, and you can see on this slide the number of lymphocytes in the blood, and it dropped after 10 days dramatically, and she was able to leave hospital. This antibody is now finding further uses. It's been found to be useful in treating multiple sclerosis. It's been, I think, being shown over the last year or so that MS is an autoimmune disease, and attack by lymphocytes is part of this, and CAMPATH is being used there. The next stage of this work that's been pioneered by Greg Winter is to attempt to bypass the use of rodents to make monoclonal antibodies. I showed on the overhead this nasty process of making antibodies from rats. And what Greg has now been able to do is to bypass this method and start making antibodies directly. Let's go over briefly how antibodies are generated normally. One has particular cells called pre-B cells, which eventually become the B cells. These pre-cells have in them the basic genes for antibodies. These antibodies genes then rearrange and form the B cells, and the B cells have on their surfaces the products of the antibody genes, the antibodies. And each cell will have on it a particular antibody corresponding to the particular gene inside it. When one is exposed to something which is antigenic, particular illness or something or other, the antigen will bind to the surface of the cell, that antibody, and it will stimulate that cell to divide and increase. And in doing so, it will start producing large amounts of antibody. And in this way, one becomes resistant to what is attacking one. Eventually, that particular cell matures, called affinity maturation, and one retains that antibody cell for future use. So if one is attacked by that particular thing again, measles or cold virus or something or other, the cell is laid down and then will be reactivated and rapidly produce antibodies. This forms what one can call a genetic display system. The important feature of this, the crucial feature, is that one has a cell which has on the surface what we would call a phenotype, and inside it has the genes, the genotype that corresponds to that phenotype. So one has the display of the phenotype on the outside and the genes on the inside. What has been done is to use the same type of system to make antibodies in the test tube. And the way this is done as follows. It's called the phage display system. There are certain viruses called bacteriophages that can infect bacteria. And these bacteriophages will grow inside the bacterium, and then they will make new copies of themselves. What's been done is to put the genes of an antibody into the bacteriophage. And they're put in a particular position that when the proteins are made from those genes, they will come on the outside of the bacteriophage. So this recombinant bacteriophage is produced, which has its normal coating of protein around the outside, but it also produces some antibody that is on the outside as well. So this is a genetic display package of phenotype on the surface and genotype inside that is equivalent to the B cell system. This is a very recent development and has been shown to work in the last, I would say, 6 months or so, and with unpublished work. And a variety of novel antibodies are being produced directly from human antibodies without having to go through this process of making rat antibodies and converting them. And this technology, I'm sure, will take over very quickly the classical process of making monoclonal antibodies. And this shows you how rapidly developments can take place in this field, and using methods such as this, animal experimentation is avoided. Let's now, having spoken about these, I think, really rather spectacular advances in medical work by using recombinant DNA work in antibodies, just briefly go over some areas of basic science that are being studied. Briefly, enzyme catalysis. As I mentioned, all reactions that take place in the cell are catalyzed by enzymes. Chemists have long admired enzymes for their activity, their specificity, their ability to catalyze a particular reaction with no side effects. The reason that enzymes can do this is that an enzyme is a protein that binds a substrate. It binds the chemical molecule on which it acts, and it targets on it in the same way as an antibody targets upon an antigen. And what an enzyme is able to do is to use the binding process to catalyze the reaction. It takes chemistry, the normal chemistry that one finds in a test tube, and to that it adds the ability to bind, and it uses the energy of binding to catalyze a reaction. In the past, this could never be studied directly, but with protein engineering, one can understand how enzymes work. And basically, to understand the difference between enzyme catalysis and normal chemical catalysis, we must find ways of measuring the interaction energy between the enzyme and the substrate as the reaction proceeds. And this has been done now for a number of enzymes over the past 10 years. And the classic case is with an enzyme called the tyrosyl tRNA synthetase. And to illustrate what can be done, I'll show you the following. This enzyme reacts together two molecules, which are shown at the center of the slide as they're joined together. There's an amino acid residue called tyrosine, and it's reacting with a compound called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is the major energy source in the cell. And this reaction is catalyzed by binding to amino acid side chains from the protein. Amino acid residues, arginines, threonines, and histidines, bind to this. By changing these amino acid residues from one into another using protein engineering, it was possible to map out how the enzyme catalyzed this type of reaction and by how much it did so in each particular case. By doing experiments such as this, one learns how an enzyme works, and so one solves an intellectual challenge, but it also provides the information that will be eventually used for designing further enzymes. Let me give you some practical examples. In North America, most sugar is made from sweet syrups which are made from corn. The corn is converted into a sweet syrup by a team of three enzymes. Crucial to this process is an enzyme called xylose isomerase. It changes the structure of one of the sugars. Now, this enzyme, when it's naturally working in a cell, has no difficulties. But in the industrial process, it's used at 70 or 80 degrees in a thick syrup. Under these conditions, one of the essential amino acid residues of the protein, a lysine residue, is attacked by a sugar molecule, and the enzyme is destroyed. But just by making a single change of this lysine residue to an arginine residue, which is similar but doesn't have that chemical reactivity, the enzyme becomes stable. The most common enzyme that is used today is an enzyme called satelicin. Satelicin is a protease. It means it chops up proteins. This enzyme is produced by a bacillus called Bacillus amanoliquefaciens. The reason it's called satelicin is that somebody once made a mistake and thought their strain was Bacillus satellus, not Bacillus amanoliquefaciens. But this protease, because of its ability to be produced cheaply and to chop up proteins, is put into soap powder. Because in the washing machine, it can digest proteins that stain clothes. And so nowadays, almost all detergents contain enzymes, and the enzyme is satelicin. Some 600 tons of satelicin are produced per annum to go into soap powder. This enzyme has been subtly altered to make it resistant to bleach. Now, if the organism that produced this enzyme had to grow in an environment of bleach, that enzyme would be naturally resistant to bleach, but it doesn't. But what one can do is to change the amino acid residues in that protein that are susceptible to attack by bleach for other ones that aren't. Further, by making random changes in the protein, various people have found that they can improve the wash performance of soap powder by using a different satelicin. Let me show you briefly some experiments that one can do and that what can alter the specificity of a particular enzyme in a rational, a semi-rational manner. And here's some experiments we've done recently on changing the specificity of satelicin. Now, what do we mean by the term specificity? The term specificity, when applied to enzymes, means the ability of an enzyme to choose the compound on which it will react. An enzyme can have a broad specificity and work on a or it can have a very narrow specificity and just work on one particular substrate. This enzyme, satelicin, recognizes the constituents of proteins. We have a chain of a protein. We have one amino acid residue going to the next, going to the next, going to the next. And satelicin will cleave a protein, but it doesn't cleave at every single residue. It just cleaves at particular positions where it recognizes particular amino acids. And so, for example, satelicin is known to be specific for particular types of amino acid residues adjacent to the bond that is cleaved. But we looked at the structure of the enzyme, and it's complex with a peptide, and thought that one could possibly make the enzyme more specific still by making alterations into it such that it recognized the amino acid residue that was four positions removed from the bond that's to be cleaved, a so-called S4 site, where the P4 residue of the protein resides. To study this, we made a series of small model peptides, which were all identical in the first three positions, but in the fourth position, we made a series of changes. We put in a small amino acid called alanine, and gradually larger and larger amino acids called valine, isoleucine, leucine, and phenylalanine. They get bigger and bigger as we go down the series. Now, if we look at the structure of the enzyme, we can use a computer graphics display to look at
the particular region of the protein that is involved, and we can make some guesses at changes we would like to make. We looked at the position where that fourth residue binds, and we saw that there was a large amino acid side chain at that position, and so we shortened it by putting another amino acid residue there, which was smaller. So instead of having an isoleucine, this large amino acid at position 107, we could put a glycine residue, which is much, much smaller. We then created a cavity in that position of the protein. And the idea was then that perhaps larger amino acid residues would fit into that cavity. And in fact, it worked. If we look at our different substrates with the enzyme, and we go from a small side chain to a larger, to a larger, to a larger one still, until we get to the largest, and we look at the rate at which this enzyme works, and the rate is given by numbers in this column, this means that the enzyme, we call it the wild-type enzyme, reacts with 35 molecules of the substrate per second, this one 34, that one 30, that one 24, that one 36. The wild-type enzyme doesn't really worry about what amino acid residue is in that position. It's just about as good with all of them. But in our mutant one, in which we made a cavity that would fit a large side chain, we find, in fact, that there is a dramatic change in its specificity. Instead of reacting with 35 molecules per second for this smaller residue, alanine, being present, it only reacts with about a third of a molecule per second. The activity has gone down by a large factor, 100. As you make the side chain larger and larger, the activity comes back again, until when we get with the larger ones, you know, such as leucine, it's as good as the original enzyme. So by making relatively simple changes, we can actually change the specificity of an enzyme and make it more suitable for working on particular substrates. And this enzyme could well be used in future as a specific reagent. Finally, let me talk briefly about protein folding. I mentioned towards the beginning of this lecture that the biggest unsolved problem in my area of work was the prediction of the three-dimensional structures of proteins, knowing their amino acid sequences only. What we need is experimental work to tackle such a problem, and the natural way of tackling it is to use protein engineering. By making a series of variations of this protein using protein engineering, one can measure experimentally all the different factors that stabilize the protein. And so from a series of experiments of altering the amino acid residues in the protein in turn and determining changes in stability of the protein, one can map out the effects of structure on stability. Also, by making measurements on how fast this protein folds up from its unfolded state and the changes in these rates from different mutants, one can actually map out which parts of the protein fold and form rapidly and which ones fold and form later. And we've been able to map out the route by which this protein folds up. And I have on this slide a coloured version of the structure on this slide. And I've coloured, in particular, the regions of the protein that fold early in blue and the regions that fold late in red. By doing experiments such as this, we're discovering what features there are in a protein that enable it to fold up. I mentioned that there are astronomical number and possibilities of structures of a protein, and if it just folded up at random, it will take longer than the age of the universe to do so. What the protein does, in fact, is to fold up with large groups of amino acid residues, folding up locally, each one guided by the next one to it. So it actually folds up in parts. By dividing a large process into smaller parts, the statistics become much more favorable. By experiments such as this, we'll eventually find the rules that govern the folding of proteins. But to come back to the main theme of what I've been saying today, is that we're able at present to make small changes in protein structure and use these small changes to make useful proteins and design further changes in proteins. And the way progress is going at the moment is really twofold. We're learning about protein design by first of all using protein engineering as an analytical technique to understand the rules of protein folding and gradually learn the theoretical basis. But the second method, which is proving of use, is to mimic evolution by mutating proteins and selecting them in vitro. Just as nature has used millions of years to evolve proteins by a process of mutation selection, so we can do the same in the test tube. By experiments of putting antibodies on the surface of bacteriophage and replicating those antibodies in bacteria and selecting the ones out that bind to particular antigens, we can make novel binding specificities. So we really have a cycle of events whereby we can use the limited means at our disposal to do bigger and better things. We go through a cycle of having a target protein. We use protein engineering to make mutations in that protein to get an engineered protein. We then study the engineered protein to learn about the changes in structure that govern changes in activity, folding, catalysis, etc. Or we can make selections by using some process of seeing whether that enzyme that's produced works better or binds better to get an improved version. And we then go through successive cycles of mutation, analysis or selection, etc., etc., to build up useful proteins and more information. Thank you. The question was just asked whether perhaps there are factors in the cell that cause a protein to fold rather than just the sequence. There are proteins in the cell that are important in protein folding called chaperones, but these do not in general work by directing the pathway of protein folding. What they do is to prevent unwanted events happening, such as precipitation and aggregation of the proteins as they're produced. And so they're basically an off-pathway process. They prevent unwanted events rather than directing the actual events. The information that governs the folding of proteins resides in their linear sequence. Yes. The question is, are there such things as prions self-replicating proteins. There's various diseases such as scrapie in sheep, mad cow disease, and there's a Creutzfeldt syndrome, in which the brain goes basically, has holes, etc., being formed in it. It's very difficult to find a causative agent for this. And it has been proposed that there are proteins that replicate themselves. I mean, one of the ideas is that one of these proteins can change its conformation and the others will follow suit. But the evidence is still very scanty on this, I think. The question is, what rules do I think the rules of stability and folding to take? Basically, the experimentalist has to provide the information that's required by the theoretician to start doing computational work. In the end, things will have to be done by computational methods. So as far as stability is concerned, if one can make measurements on the stability of small parts of the protein structure rather than the whole structure itself, this gives means to the theoretician to benchmark his or her calculations on a small part of the protein, and those things will improve. As far as the overall folding pathway is concerned, one asks specific questions as, are there initiation sites for folding, etc., etc.? How does the folding process start? Well, already, I think we're getting ideas of what's happening. It appears that in the proteins that have been studied so far, the helical regions of the protein have within them enough information to start folding by themselves. And it seems that the driving force for initiation of folding is the burial of hydrophobic surface area. So one can start looking for patterns of this within proteins. The question I think was basically, can we engineer organisms to help with the sewage problems of British Columbia? That type of problem is in fact tackled, is really a classic target for classical microbiology. Maybe protein engineering can help.
The information that you get about these proteins, I gather that most of this comes from crystallography.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Much of it, yes.
But the question is, with the development of these scanning tunneling microscopes, is it possible just looking at the outside of these proteins to get enough information to be useful?
The question was, can we use tunneling microscopy to study the structure of proteins? The answer is probably no, I would guess. The trouble is the information you get is too gross a level. The resolution is too poor. But in addition to X-ray crystallography nowadays, NMR is proving very useful at solving protein structures. And until recently, in the last few years, structures of molecules in solution up to molecular masses about 15,000 have been solved by NMR. And now by using isotopic incorporation methods, it's probable that the structures of proteins in solution up to molecular masses of 25,000 will be solved. But you really need things at high resolution to be useful. I didn't quite hear the first part of your question, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry. I just cannot understand what you're asking. I'm sorry. It's
I think what he's asking is there's some evidence that between nine proteins for entire function directly without having to go through the primary function, this is maybe more difficult to use the basis with nine proteins than that.
Yes. The question was, rather than design a protein from scratch, it might be possible to use known elements and put them together. Yes, in some cases that will be so, but you'll have a limited number of possibilities. And let me say, the problem of predicting protein structure really falls into two halves. On the one hand, there's an enormous amount of information coming out of the genome sequencing projects, and that really constitutes one problem. If a protein structure, a protein sequence is found in a genome sequencing project, then that protein occurs in nature, and one can assume that that protein will fold up, because otherwise it wouldn't be there. So all one has to do is to find the most probable fold of that protein. And that type of process can probably be done statistically when a very large number of protein structures have been solved by X-ray crystallography and NMR. When enough are known, it will probably be possible to predict at some lower resolution the structures of the others. When it comes to designing totally new proteins from scratch, then one has the problem of having to predict whether or not the protein that is formed will actually be stable. So that's going to be far more difficult. I know nothing about that.
You mentioned the enzyme. enzymes in the soil. What do they do when they get in the water supply?
Those enzymes really are very unstable. They wouldn't last very long. They actually eat each other up. So perhaps you'll have one left, one individual molecule left. I think some people are allergic to these enzymes, and that's been I think known for a long period of time, especially in the solid form.
One last question.
This is not my sphere of expertise. I better not answer that.
I'd now like to call upon Dr. Julian Davies of the UBC Department of Microbiology to thank our speaker tonight.
Good evening. When I was asked if I would give a vote of thanks, I readily agreed. But I had a terrible feeling just after this, because the only time in my life that I've ever given a vote of thanks before, and this was also for a member of the Fellow of the Royal Society who came from Cambridge, A, I insulted him, and secondly, I spoke for too long. And I hope that tonight I won't do either of these two things. I think what Alan Furst has given us tonight is a presentation of the state of the art. And I don't want you to go away thinking that science has changed the original alchemist idea of trying to convert lead into gold, of trying to convert proteins into dollars or some form of hard currency. Anything but lira, obviously. But I think that what he has told us today, this evening, is what is a major problem in science. And I think this is something that is very, very difficult to comprehend unless you are faced with this kind of problem. And it's the problem of taking linear information and converting it into three-dimensional information. And until we can solve that problem, we are not going to understand the functioning of most of the molecules that are concerned with life. If your proteins don't fold properly, you've had it. So we have to learn what is happening in this particular area. And it's the kind of work that Alan Furst is doing that is leading us to an understanding of this kind of thing. And it's going to lead us to an application, to the applications that come from an understanding of protein folding and how we convert first dimension information into three-dimensional information. I think we've been privileged to hear such a presentation this evening, and I would like you all to join me in thanking Alan for his talk. Thank you.